Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This is the Yanks Go Yard Podcast with Adam Weinrib and Thomas Carinante.
Welcome to the Yanks Go Yard Podcast. I'm Adam Weinrib alongside Thomas Carinante. Man, this is definitely the time when you have to check your expectations just a little bit and make sure not to get too high on the way the New York Yankees are playing. I mean, look, it's more fun to go crazy because they've earned the crazy so far. We have to keep perspective. It's just May. It's just the White Sox. You can do that all you want, but that's seven in a row. When they're going right, when the lineup is at its deepest, when the pitching looks like this, no matter the opponent, it just feels a little easier than it should, like 15% easier than it should. And what's crazy now is that they took that punch in Baltimore, lost 3 out of 4. We're starting to have the right conversations about entering the Tiger series too. Is the offense just busted? When are we going to break out? When are we going to get the breakout that it seemed like we were going to get earlier in the season? Turned out it was just, hey, Alex Verdugo's back and he's back from the paternity list and now everything works again. So remarkable run from the starting pitching, absurd run from the offense. They fell behind in all of these games and just effortlessly punched back immediately Saturday, Sunday, and had to hold on a little bit for dear life at the end of the first game of the series. I would say second and third, one out for Caleb Ferguson in the eighth. It's a bit dear lifey, but he got out of it. And now we get to talk about a sweep, and now we head into another big test for the Yankees in this four-game set against the Seattle Mariners, where they face four pitchers, every single one of them who you go, I don't really want to face that guy. Well, guess what? Right now, the Yankees starting pitchers are the I don't really want to face that guy for the other guys. So the Mariners offense, struggling, streaky is generous. This should be a very interesting test as the AL West theoretical contenders come into the Bronx this week. We're going to be talking all about the White Sox set. I am Adam Weinrib. Thomas Carinante is here. And after this is done, after we're done recapping, stay tuned for an interview with Andy Martino, SNY's Andy Martino, about the Yankee way, his rundown of the Brian Cashman era, an inside look at what turned this team into whatever you would agree that it is now, how Brian Cashman put his stamp on this franchise. And there are a lot of inside baseball stories here that are really eye-opening for Yankee fans of any level of care about the machinations of behind the scenes and what goes on in the front office. Definitely a wild read, and it was great to talk to Andy, so we will run that at the end of the show. It'll be up on YouTube as a separate video. Anyway, Thomas Carinante, welcome to the show. We're sweeping again.
What a time to be alive, man. I am going to ride the high because you know why? I take in the lows very hard like the rest of us do. Much like gambling, right? Caesar Sportsbook here for the highs and lows. They are looking to cover your first bet up to $1,000. New customers will get a second chance bet up to $1,000 when you sign up with our promo code YGY1000. That means if your first bet loses, you will get your full wager returned as a bonus bet. Again, up to $1,000. 1000. Caesars offers daily profit boosts as well as Caesars rewards credits on every single wager, which can be redeemed for bonuses, sports tickets, and other VIP experiences. Signing up with our code YGY1000, don't forget it, not only covers your first bet, but it also gets you access to their fantastic rewards program. So if you're looking to join Caesars, go ahead and download the app, register with our promo code YGY1000, and make sure that first bet is covered. And make it a good one, damn it. $1,000 is a lot of money. This offer is only available to new customers who are 21 and older and physically present in legal gambling states. Please remember to always gamble responsibly. Check the episode description for full terms of the offer to see if you qualify. Man, I was a part-time Yankees fan this weekend, not in a bad way. They were just playing the White Sox, and I invest a lot of time in the Yankees. Really didn't feel like I needed to watch 27 innings against the White Sox.
You got the Knickerbockers, too. Did not go well, but obviously we're all watching that. It makes sense. I was away bachelor party weekend. It got 13% as crazy as you think it did based on that statement. A lot of poker being one of those. Let's deal, you know, should we get stogies? No, we shouldn't kind of bachelor party. But we both were stepped away, and the Yankees made our jobs very easy by just winning three games and winning at least two of them in a way where you're like, man, it is just the score just keeps going up. They're not stopping. They're leaving guys on base, and it doesn't really matter. There was really very little to be upset about, and the starting pitching is going to be the story, and it should be because they're on a run and it's continuing and they're gassing each other up. But when Juan Soto is that, and when Aaron Judge is that, it's just kind of like, good luck to the Chicago White Sox, who sent Mike Clevinger up against us, who we never hit, who sent Brad Keller with a 2 ERA up against us, who sent, one of their leading theoretical
Chris Flexen.
Chris Flexen, who's like a guy who we've always looked at as like, oh, that's an interesting depth piece. Remember when we were talking about trading Glaber for a DFA'd Chris Flexen? Three representative arms. Not usually when you face a terrible team, there's one guy in there who's made two big league starts and has an 8.34 ERA, and you're like, is he going to shut us down, or are we just take care of business? Because that's what, and usually like 92% of the time you kick that guy's ass, but you remember the 8% because you're like, we never hit these guys, even though you usually do. Three solid big league starters this weekend. Clevinger in a rough spot, but he usually kills us. He pitched the best against us, but again, early deficit, quick equalizer, add on, home run, add on. Luis Gil stole the weekend, but these were three pretty it was nice to just have some wins where the score just went up, and the White Sox score never really moved.
It's really the equalizers that are doing it for me. And we've done it, I think, in the last few series where we go down early. And like Luis Gil's performance, we'll talk about that a lot. But yeah, first inning didn't look great, gets knocked around, and then returns to break the Yankees franchise record for strikeouts. And for a rookie, El Duque, who threw out that first pitch that night, which was absolutely incredible. So the way that the offense is allowing the pitching staff to be confident, and the way that the pitching staff is responding to the run production is something we really haven't seen in a while, because these units have very much been out of sync for these last few years. You didn't really think it would be that way because this team is so talented, but everybody's stepping up in a way that you have to appreciate. You have to, again, I think you have to ride this high as you possible. I wouldn't go like talking shit to every other fan base.
Yes.
But I wouldn't be opposed to blowing smoke up your own ass about how good your team is. This is arguably the most exciting Yankees team we've seen in, I guess in 15 years. Like, I know we were, 2017 was exciting, right? But that wasn't expected. That team was not that great. No. They rode the underdog mentality.
Underperformed their Pythagorean reality too. Like they went 90-72, and the data showed they should have had like 95 or 96 wins. So they were actually losing games at a rate they shouldn't have, and then turn it on in the playoffs.
Yeah, and that, like, Brian Cashman had a very good deadline that year. Like, got the Yankees exactly what they needed for the roster that they had. 2019 was a very exciting team. I mean, 2018, everybody was the most excited about, and then it got derailed by the Red Sox, as we talk about far too often on this podcast. Let's stop talking about that.
Yeah, no more.
2019 was the next most exciting, and then it feels like every other year was just a disappointment. Like, even with 22, like, you look at the Yankees' record now, I think over the weekend there was a stat put out, and it was like the second best start in Yankees history behind 2022, and you're like, what the fuck? are you talking about? 2022 was like, you don't even remember how good that regular season was, because everything that happened from August 1st on was like, just throw me into a river. So that's why I'm going to ride the highs here. You know, this pitching stat, this team, the Yankees are beating bad teams in the manner that they should. They're punching back against opponents and bucking the narrative of like, oh, the every other time a team had scored a run against the Yankees early on, it felt like the game was over. And we obviously knew it wasn't, but it felt like an insurmountable uphill battle. If they went down 2-0 in the first or 1-0 in the first, even depending on who was on the mound, you're just like, here we go again. It's going to be one of those nights. And now it doesn't. Now it has the 2019 vibes where it's like, yeah, go score 3 runs in the first. Good luck. Good luck against the middle of this lineup. See if your starter can get through it. And most haven't.
Yeah, 2022 is just such a weird one in retrospect. Even when they were clicking and when they were winning all the time, which they certainly were, you were looking at the opponents like, it was 2 out of every 3 starts felt like it was that guy with the 8.64 ERA. I remember that series against the Cubs where they just murked the dudes who threw Saturday and Sunday, and Matt Carpenter was a big part of that. And you're like, man, I mean, admittedly, it did have that same, this is too easy feeling. But at no point did you feel like they were battle tested by the top tier. They didn't face the Red Sox forever, and neither has this team, by the way, even though the Yankees just passed the Red Sox for rotation ERA. Shout out to the New York Yankees. But yeah, they haven't faced the Red Sox yet. Not that that's going to be the way this season is defined, hopefully. But this team has already gone through 4 in Houston. Like, the Yankees first face off with Houston in 2022. They split the series, but it took that miracle Aaron Hicks homer in the opener. Then Houston beat up Seve. Then Houston shut down the Yankees and beat Garrett Cole in what I believe was a combined no-hitter. And then shut down the Yankees the next day, too, and they came back and tied it late. Judge walked it off. Great, great theater in that series. But the Yankees scored 1 run in the 18 innings of the 2 middle games, which they lost. They end that series 53-20. The record is incredible, but you're leaving it going, I don't know about this Houston thing. They go on the road and face Houston 3 more times and get swept in that road series, including a nasty walk-off where, I don't know, remember Michael King trying to preserve? It was right after the All-Star break, ball bounced around the infield. Either way, at no point in that season did you feel secure in the offense's ability to be relentless. You would have games where they'd win 15-4, and then you'd have 3 games in a row that they'd win 3-1, lose 4-2, win 5. You know, you just never knew. This is the first stretch in a long time where the pitching is clicking to an absurd degree without Garrett Cole, and the offense just looks, you are getting contributions up and down the lineup. Mm-hmm. We'll talk unsung heroes shortly, but you got a couple of guys at the bottom of the lineup who, remember last year, remember the depth of the Yankees lineup last year. Imagine relying on the 7 through 9 guys at any point. And now you absolutely can do that. An inning is never over. Who's the guy you want to see up least right now? Probably Oswaldo Cabrera, who is the best hitter in the lineup for the first 2 weeks. I guess Jamai Jones by default, but there are no easy outs. No automatic outs. Nobody who still hit into too many double plays. We all know that. Still, there are going to be games where they leave too many runners on base. This Mariners series, again, is going to be a real test. We're going to have to see, okay, there's no weak spot in this rotation. What does that look like? Are they able to attack? Are they able to ambush any of these guys? Are they able to get their pitch count up? Or is every game in this series kind of a slog and it's just whose offense is slightly more functional? We don't know. But you know what you have to do coming into a Mariners series? Go on the road and take care of business against a really tough and hot Twins team. And 2002 doesn't matter. Your history with this franchise doesn't matter. These Twins are on fire. You got to go tame them on the road. They don't just win the series, they sweep. All right, come home, face the White Sox. 3 major league pitchers. The White Sox are playing a little better now. Tommy Pham's hitting .350. Take care of the White Sox. And again, you can't just win 2 out of 3. So when Carlos Rodon goes down 2-0 yesterday and there's a runner on third with 1 out and you're like starting to 2022, 2023, rationalize it like 2 out of 3 is okay. Not bad. Just had to win the series. But in the back of your mind, you know, these 4 tough games against the Mariners are coming and you're like, I guess we could get swept in that, man. I hope we don't lose 5 in a row. And then what happens if we, what about then? A lot of pressure on that sixth game. Nope. 2-0 to 2-2 like that. The immediate equalizer, like you said, very impressive. And then from there, who delivers but John Birdie? The 3-run home run at that point, it's 5-2, still early in the game. And yet it feels like two things. Oh, my God, they did it again. And two, it's 5-2. It's a 3-run game. It's already somewhat out of reach. And Caleb Ferguson getting out of that 4-2 jam. And the first one helped lead to that feeling a little bit of like slim lead. But still, I have a feeling like they're going to have a way to take care of this. And the reason why is, A, the offense, deep, relentless, continues to add on, good at manufacturing insurance runs. And the second reason is just the pitching staff is completely out of their minds right now. And so this is where I think we have to pay tribute to Luis Gil, who, like you said, 6 innings, 5 hits, 1 run, 1 walk, 14 Ks, 98 pitches in 6 innings. The ERA is down to 2.39, but 29 pitches and the bases loaded and 2 outs in the first makes it even more ridiculous. So of all the guys who've continued this stretch of 7 innings, 1 run, 6 innings, no runs, 6 innings, Rodon going 6 innings, 2 runs, I guess is the worst start. Shame on you. Should have done better, man. What a bummer. Terrible. Gives up 2 runs in the second. You're like, the streak is over. No, it's not. Good job, Carlos. But Heel is the one who is going to get our plaudits here. Heel is the one who gets the cosmic stuff, the El Duque first pitch, and then breaking El Duque's rookie record minutes later, like David Cone and Don Larson and Yogi Berra on Yogi Berra Day, the perfect game. And Heel is the one who got the Jeff Passan tweet, which I would like to read now on the podcast.
Very nice, yeah.
I want to say it out loud. The New York Yankees are the best team in the American League right now because Juan Soto and Aaron Judge are absurd, yes, but their starting pitching has been phenomenal all season. And that's been without Gerrit Cole. Luis Gil emasculated the White Sox today. And this led to some great replies of people saying, the Orioles have played fewer games than the Yankees. What about the Orioles? They still don't have the best duo in the AL East. Here's a picture of Henderson and Rutschman. Again, say what you want to say. Say Orioles in the comments. That's not going to sway Jeff Passan. Jeff Passan said it's the Yankees. You may think the Orioles are the best team in the American League. You in fact do, because you said it. Jeff Passan disagrees. He didn't forget about the Orioles. He watched the totality of what the Yankees have built and what they're doing, and he's hoping they're not peaking. He's also saying right now, by the way, plenty of room for interpretation. They could be peaking in May, but right now, the machine-like efficiency of this rotation plus this offense has been a joy to watch. They take care of business. They add on, and the pitching, led by someone who a lot of people said in spring training should be a reliever, is the best in the game at this moment in time.
Yeah. Don't forget, Passan also shit on the Yankees earlier this year. Not in a bad way, but he was on the Pat McAfee show and was asked about the Orioles and the Yankees battling it out for the AL East and potentially the American League. And he said that the Orioles are what Yankees fans wish the Yankees were. And I totally disagreed with that because I don't wish my team tanked for fucking 5 years to get to where they are now. And, what have Orioles fans, all they've been talking about for the past 7 years is prospects. Like, I hate, like, tracking the prospects. And being, oh man, like, where, how are we going to fit this guy in? Who's going to be, it's like, no, like, focus on the guys who are at the big league level who can actually get you to where you need to go, instead of worrying about how to project a prospect. And look, I know that's rich coming from us or me because the Yankees never have prospects and there's nothing ever to look forward to. But even if you do look around the league, you know that prospect, it's a tough business. A lot of these guys don't pan out. Tough numbers game that usually doesn't work out in an organization's favor. So like, no, I don't want to be the Orioles. I would love Gunnar Henderson and Adley Rutschman. But I wouldn't have wanted to have endured 5 years of awful, awful baseball to maybe get my hands on both of them. So this goes both ways. The Orioles were the hot discussion coming into the season. They added Corbin Burnes at the buzzer. They had a number of returning guys who were going to build off of big campaigns, and Passan was bullish on that. Yankees came back and they've delivered the haymaker over the last two-ish months, in my opinion. The Orioles have a long way to go before proving anything. They are a very good young team. There's a lot to look forward to with them, but They got to prove it in October. I know the Yankees still have to do that too, but at least the Yankees have been there a majority of the years for the past decade. The Orioles haven't. But anyway, Luis Gil, the 14 strikeouts, absolutely incredible. What is still boggling my mind is that he leads the American League, or maybe it's all of baseball. I can never decipher the stats through Baseball Reference because they just bold it, and it could be one league or the other.
They bold it and bold italic it. And also
– yeah, what's the difference?
One's whole league, one's American League.
Yeah. Oh, so the italic is the whole league?
I think so, but it's also impossible to tell what's italicized. Maybe my eyes just suck. My eyes might just be bad.
But yeah, bolded on Luis Gil's Baseball Reference page, 4.8 hits per nine inning. That's absolutely, absolutely incredible.
That indicates he led the league, which I assume is the American League.
Yes.
Because there's no – usually there's a clarifier that says bold italic means he led all of baseball, but it's not there because he doesn't lead all of baseball in anything. But I guess that's how their UX works.
Great. So, I mean, the American League has a lot of good pitchers. The American League, you would argue – well, DH is universal now, so I shouldn't say that. But, yeah, the American League has a lot of good offensive teams in it. The Yankees haven't had the easiest schedule to start the year. Luis Gil had to – again, the biggest storyline here is that you said he shouldn't have been in the rotation. There was no projection of him being in the rotation as long as Gerrit Cole was healthy and as long as all these other guys took the necessary steps that they needed to. And you look at his peripheral metrics too. Like a lot of people might look at the 2.39 ERA, is it? Yeah, 2.39 ERA, 3.13 FIP, and 1.08 WHIP. You're saying, okay, well, what's going on under the hood? Well, everything's good with the exception of chase rate, walk percentage, and ground ball rate. But again, does ground ball rate matter if you're barely giving up contact? No. Does walk rate – walk rate does matter. His walk rate's a little bit concerning, but to me that's a give and take. He's giving up no contact, and the three hits more that he should probably be giving up every start are being substituted for walks, which I'm not necessarily against because – There's an issue if you're giving up walks and can't get out of jams and also give up contact. Luis Gil's not giving up contact, so if he wants to issue free passes and be able to get out of those situations, then be my guest. Chase rate, to me, here, irrelevant because he's getting a ton of strikeouts.
In the zone, 90-mile-an-hour fastballs and 92-mile-an-hour changeups.
So to me, these three flaws on his resume at this moment, the only blue areas of his baseball savant page, they don't matter to me. They need to be viewed in that vacuum where it's like, okay, how is this a negative trait and how are teams capitalizing on it? Teams are not capitalizing on it and they're not really negative at this point. So look, another reason I'm going to ride the high is because this is unsustainable. I love Luis Gil. We loved him when he debuted back in 2021. We felt so bad for him when he had to go undergo Tommy John surgery in 2022, which was supposed to be an exciting year. But I think we could all say this is a unsustainable pace for everybody, even for Clark Schmidt. I think Clark Schmidt's having a great year. I think his development has taken tremendous leaps that I never expected because I've actually been a big critic of him. But We have to brace ourselves for the regression. I don't think it's going to be a massive regression, but second half comes. I don't think we're sustaining a 4 or 5 people in this rotation that are in the Cy Young race. If we do, God bless, but not really a likely thing.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
Yeah, and the thing with him getting a rotation spot this spring was, the argument was, even without Cole, I mean, once Cole's gone, you know, you're probably going to, are you going to lean with experience? You're going to lean with Cody Poteet in the rotation, or maybe even Luke Weaver was a potential option at a certain point. He's become, now it seems ludicrous, 2 months ago to say, our second best reliever, Luke Weaver, should he be a starter? But he'll fought his way in there. But he was really battling it out for a long time with someone who had established himself in the rotation last year, but maybe didn't satisfy the needs and desires and couldn't get lefties out, couldn't harness the cutter and couldn't figure out a way to get through the lineup the third time. And to be fair, struggled with that at times to start this year as well. But that's Clark Schmidt, who, it's May 20th, it's not July. But at this moment in time, pencils down, the Yankees probably have two All-Stars, and it's Luis Gil and Clark Schmidt. Schmidt just got through eight innings against those Twins. We were just talking earlier about, hey, you can't just take the series. You got to sweep when you start off with two wins. Who made sure they did that? Schmidt's eight innings, three hits, eight strikeouts, and he was better against lefties than righties. All eight of his Ks came against lefty batters, which used to be the side of the plate that he couldn't handle. I called this man fart shit on a podcast last year. Felt bad about it. It was an accident. I didn't do it on purpose because I actually think I said – well, I was calling him that in private. So I think I said Clark shit by accident.
You just outed yourself.
Yeah, well, I think I called him Clark shit by accident because I was thinking about how I used to say that in private.
You know, again, it actually makes sense for what's happening.
Yes, oops. But he was really, really frustrating last year, and he was always clogging the bases, putting guys on base. And this year, it's been night and day, and I think you can credit Andy Pettit for a lot of this. Not just working with Rodon, but people are acting like he is. I mean, Matt Blake, we know what Matt Blake is. There's nobody better at devising a program, making pitchers pitch to their strengths. Matt Blake versus Andrew Bailey is an extremely fun fisticuffs. Hopefully it ends after this year when Bailey leaves to go manage the Miami Marlins. But for now, very fun. And Andy Pettit has just added like an additional know-how, tinkering, teaching pitches, teaching metal, teaching mentality. And I think we're probably about 10 days away from the first like fake All-Star roster projections coming out. I would say that both of those guys should be on there, and both have to overcome the fact that they are not marquee name brand starters. Yeah. But I do think Heal getting the 14 Ks this weekend gives him the advantage over Schmidt for now, if only one of them's going to get to go. And then, you know, a guy like Carlos Rodon, who after this start, said, this feels like home. We've given him a lot of love this year after a terrible year last year, but man, how fucking good does that feel to hear? Incredible. And if you tell me that, like, hey, it's actually Carlos Rodon with the name recognition that gets to go to the All-Star game instead of Clark Schmidt, I don't think Clark Schmidt's going to mind that one bit. The numbers would favor Schmidt at this point in time, but 55 innings, 55 Ks, 3.27 ERA, 10 starts, 5-2 and 0.8 B war for the Yankees number two starter and somebody who had a disaster of a year last year. If you told me he goes and Schmidt stays, I would go, okay, great. No worries. A deserved honor for somebody else who's really putting in the work this year.
Absolutely. I think that's been their work has been the best. Luis Gil calling Gerrit Cole a professor after the game was so great. That cracked me up. I don't know if that was like a translation error or he was actually saying like Gerrit Cole's a great professor. We have a great college professor.
I think he's just saying that. I think he's saying that.
Really funny. But yeah, you have to also look at the lens, like look at Gerrit Cole's value through that lens, in my opinion, just because he's not on the mound. There's many other ways Gerrit Cole is valuable. Again, Yankee fans have been hard on Gerrit Cole. I've been hard on Gerrit Cole. A lot of expectations coming in with all that money and with the unrest with how the Yankees have not had that ace caliber pitcher for so long, but he's really found his footing the last few years. I think he's gotten a lot more comfortable. He's taken on that mentor role for all these other guys in the rotation, even for his peers, like Stroman's his peer, Carlos Rodon's his peer, and they are clearly absorbing information from him and they're valuing it a ton. And guys like Luis Gil and Clark Schmidt, just they immediately come to class. There's no question. They're sitting down, notebooks open, undivided attention for however long the session's going on for. So I think that is also a big key here for looking at how the rotation's developing and how the flow of information is helping everybody get more comfortable and produce better results.
Yeah, it's been a joy. And the moment I was happiest was just Heal's entire start on Saturday, especially with the El Duque thing, especially with the photos they got to take after the game. Very 1999 coded, very one of that, a reminder of one of the happiest years of my life when everything about the Yankees just sort of made sense. Like, they had dynasties. They win championships. They take care of business. And sometimes the legends come back and sometimes the ghosts show up and we can't explain it, but that just happens. That's what that reminded me of. Unsung hero in this series, you can go with, the starters all deserve. Remember when the Atlanta Hawks were all the player of the week or whatever? It was like the whole starting five and everyone who wasn't a Hawks fan was like, that was lame. Like, yeah, we could do that. I mean, good thing this is a Yankees podcast. I don't think Yankees fans would say that was pathetic to name the whole rotation and everyone who followed them in the bullpen, even Michael Tonkin, an unsung hero.
Yeah.
But Jose Trevino, who's playing like an all-star for the second time in 3 years as well and deserves some respect. The birdie homer, Ferguson in the opener, also a moment to deserve credit. But it's now we're at a tough spot because the Yankees are not going to have 12 all-stars. It's not usual. It's not very, typical for us to have to do this because Aaron Judge, Juan Soto, they're probably going to go to the game, especially with the way Aaron Judge is swinging the bat, but they're probably going to get voted in as starters. Usually Gerrit Cole's a shoe-in. Of course, this year he will not be attending. Clay Holmes has a 0 ERA right now. I would wager that you can't leave him off. I think you got to go with two of the Yankee starters. It's Heal and Schmidt for me, but if it's Heal and Rodon for you, I don't blame you. And then beyond that, Giancarlo Stanton has an argument. Jose Trevino has an argument. Anthony Volpe's top 10 in WAR in baseball this year. He has an argument. Alex Verdugo is a glue guy. He's not going to make it. But there could be an uncomfortable number of Yankees that make people whine and cry about how Yankee-centric this is. But right now, the record is demanding it. The performance is demanding it. And if the Yankees don't get too many All-Stars and Trevino at a thin position doesn't make the team, then the whole snub list is going to be like three or four Yankees because they have a lot of deserving players and a lot of them are people that the rest of, baseball fans have probably counted out and said, we don't think about those guys this year. Well, you actually do because they deserve spots.
Start thinking about them. Start thinking about them, all right?
Start it.
John Birdie's my all-star. I'm voting him in. No, I'm kidding. He's my unsung hero. That three-run homer. You look at the – and we talked about it, right? You feel like – you have to sweep the White Sox. Sweeps in baseball are hard.
For sure.
The White Sox are bad. The Yankees usually don't do this, or at least haven't in recent years, where it's like, can we get the cushion that we need? Because look, if you win a series against a team that's 14-33 and 4-19 on the road, you win two out of three, you've gained one game. It's not enough. It's not, it just isn't. And I know that the grind of the baseball season is difficult, especially with all the factors you have working against you, with pitching on the Yankee side. Like, they're dealing with some bullpen issues, so that always affects how you're able to get through games. So that's why John Birdie's home run on Sunday was probably one of the most important turns in this series. It gave the Yankees a three-run cushion in the middle of the game where at that point where Carlos Rodon was feeling more comfortable to pitch, and the bullpen probably knew at that point, okay, we're not going to need all hands on deck. Let's have Carlos Rodon relax a little bit these next two, three innings. We'll get him through it, and then we'll figure out a plan. So in terms of securing the sweep, which really is important because you have to bank these wins early on because you don't know what's going to come. You don't know who's going to hit the IL. You don't know – when you're going to start slumping again, because that's inevitable, especially for the Yankees. Like, the offensive downturn will come. Don't you worry. We're riding the high right now because this is how it's supposed to look. This is what we envisioned with this team fully together, but don't you worry. There will be another 18, 19 inning streak where this team looks like they don't belong in the major leagues. And then maybe you get a walk-off situation like they had against the Tigers to turn it all around. But either way, John Birdie's home run, to give that cushion, to provide this lineup. He's been solid. I know he's had a couple of errors over the last couple of weeks where it's like, damn it, man, just get that one. Come on. But he's been solid with the bat. He's been lengthening this lineup. He's providing speed on the base paths. And that's to me that the cushion at the end of that game was among the most valuable of the series.
100% agreed.
Moments.
Yeah, 100% agreed. You are going to, you're one bad 2 days offense away from the same people who tweet all the time, tweeting about how the magic is gone from the 2024 Yankees. That's why we caution you. Hey, just like don't get your World Series tattoos, because those are the kind of people who tweet after a weird bad week. Like, I knew it. I knew they were going to lose some games. Congrats to you. They are going to lose some games. But this does seem more sustainable than it has at the very least since 2019. And that year, the team was just decimated. And in 2018, love that team too, there was a 108-win juggernaut Red Sox team in their way. This year, there doesn't appear to be, which is crazy to say, at least not in the American League. Because the Dodgers could easily be that juggernaut. We maybe have not seen them in their final form yet. Still waiting for Kershaw, et cetera, et cetera. I hear you. But in the American League, at least, it does not seem that there is that. There are some tough foes. The Red Sox and their nearly league-leading ERA are going to be difficult. The Orioles and their core are going to be difficult if they can get one more reliable starting pitcher in there and shore up the back end of the bullpen. I think they're the second-best team in the American League right now, but I agree with Jeff Passan. I think the Yankees are the best. So there will be some challenges. The reigning world champions are in the American League. The Philadelphia Phillies have an absurd record. Very good baseball teams and some very bad baseball teams, but I think the Yankees belong in the conversation with all of them, as opposed to 2019 and 2018, when it felt like, very good team, probably a tick below. Or 2019, very good team, maybe not quite enough starting pitching, and maybe they could hang if they were able to get one injury break, but they haven't gotten one all year, and oh, look, Giancarlo Stanton's out of the ALCS again. So this year feels like there are challenges yet to come, absolutely. But all things considered, it feels like they're a cut above their competition outside of maybe the Dodgers and Phillies, and depending on how you feel about the Orioles. But I'd put the Yankees a half step above the Orioles right now. Just a half step. Strangest moment of this series.
The Orioles. The people debating they're not ahead of the Orioles right now, like in terms of looking like the better team. They look like the better team.
They absolutely do. And and if you want to use head-to-head against them, you can.
Right now, again, right now. Could change in 2 weeks. But if we're talking power rankings, the Yankees are ahead.
Absolutely. It's not, I mean, close. It depends on what your definition of close is, but the Yankees are
definitely close, but there's an obvious answer. You know what I like? Yes. That's where it's like, it's not like, oh, the Yankees are miles ahead. It's like, no, the Yankees are, they're right there, but the Yankees are very much over the last few weeks. They're widening the gap.
You know how I know you don't watch ball? The people who are just like, it's the Braves. No, right now it's not the Braves. The Braves are like two starting pitchers short, and the Braves are on the verge of like teetering into some real questionable territory. Might it be the Braves in September? Absolutely. We know what the Braves pedigree is, but right now don't just pencil them ahead of any of these teams. The Braves might be sixth or seventh at the moment. I mean, oddest moment in this series, the weirdest moment for me, it's just the bizarre feeling of Corey Jolks robbing a home run down 7-2 and going absolutely nuts on Sunday. Good for him. He homered also in this series. I will also throw in Mike Soroka, loaded the bases but worked out of it, was hitting 96 on the gun and was dominant in relief and made you go, why didn't he start this game? Brad Keller was the guy? Okay, sure. I mean, there were definitely some moments. Tommy Pham, look every time Tommy Pham came up and you looked at his numbers and you were like, this guy was unsigned into late April coming off a World Series hero run and is now hitting 350 for the worst team in the American League Central. Got it. Sure. Overall, I mean, not too weird a series though, because all of these moments came in games where the Yankees were leading handily. And so you couldn't really, I'm very accustomed to getting the Talking Yanks push notifications on my wrist. And every time I see something like whelp, I'm like, oh my God, they gave up a grand slam, or like, oh my God, they blew a 4-run lead. And it was like a whelp for a judge strikeout with the bases loaded up 6-1. And I was like, oh, I mean, that's a bummer, but it's not like not like a whelp. Like most of these, the weirdest moments were kind of buried. Cause again, they were just sort of ticking off the boxes to get to the finish line, to get to a victory.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what was more weird for me, like Benintendi check swing single, RBI,
Yeah.
diving catch on that Stanton missile. But I'd have to go with the bird on the field. Like, what was that?
Oh, yeah. Right. I forgot about the bird.
What if we stop the game for a bird being on the field?
Yeah.
Aren't birds ranking, just everywhere?
If you're ranking animals that deserve game stoppage, it's like cat, squirrel, bird, way down the list. Below human, below fan on the field. Yeah. A bird. I mean, sometimes there are six birds in the outfield.
Yeah. Like a plastic bag, like a bird is probably less of a priority than a plastic bag.
I would agree with that. I would rank bird below bag.
And like if they were trying to protect the bird, maybe the bird was injured. Was he, I don't know, well, he was standing there hanging out. Maybe she was standing there hanging out and they caught it pretty easily, which I was surprised by that. But I don't know if I've ever seen a game stop because of a bird hanging out. Birds maybe are there. We are where birds live. We should be taken off the field so the birds can be on the field.
That's a take.
That's where the birds belong. We don't belong
that's
here.
That's a take. Did you have a call?
Birds aren't real people. People are about to get pissed, dude.
Yeah. RIP your mentions on Twitter, the bird app itself.
Former bird app. They changed it to X.com.
Changed it to X.com over the weekend while I was away, and good for them finally getting that done. Ruthless efficiency, getting that done 9 months in or whatever. Yeah, there was a little bird. There was a little bird on the field. Maybe it was an Oriole trying to get a jump on the power rankings, try to take out some Yankees, see if you can grab that number one spot temporarily. Getting in Jeff Passan's mentions. Yeah, no, I mean, easily, I don't know how I didn't get there sooner. Easily the weirdest moment of the weekend was the loose bird.
Bird?
Most surprising moment, though, for me, Jose Trevino, again,
what is
my guy. My guy taking the weekend series for me. I think about Trevino first, faking out the runner at third by appealing and then getting the back pick. I'm honestly not even sure if he intended to do that. He's a smart catcher. He's got a lot of talent. It was a heads up play, but I genuinely think he was just appealing to first and then happened to notice, oh my God, this guy is crawling down the line. Why is he doing that? And went and got him. I don't think it was an elaborate scheme. It might've been, and credit to Trevino if it was, and I wouldn't put it past him, but that was the most surprising, like something that I don't even think was supposed to be something that worked like a charm. And that's how you know the White Sox are the White Sox. So that gave me less hope moving forward for when a team I hate, like Houston or Baltimore or Boston or Tampa, has to face the White Sox. Tampa already got swept by the White Sox, so shout out.
Yeah.
But when they have to face the White Sox and the White Sox are coming to Fenway or something, I have no hope. I'm like, all right, I've seen this movie. This is pointless.
Yeah. I mean, surprising moment for me, Caleb Ferguson, dude. I know you mentioned it earlier, but like, what?
Yeah.
What? Why was that the choice? Aaron Boone deserves a lot of credit this year because when you're not talking about the manager,
mm-hmm.
that means the manager is either diverting your attention or he's making the correct moves. And to me, it seems like Aaron Boone has made the correct moves or has pressed the right buttons. Combination of both. Caleb Ferguson, no business coming in that situation.
Yeah.
Based on how he's performed with A, runners on, B, in high leverage situations, and just C, overall. He's been bad. We talked about him being a potential DFA candidate down the road. The fact that he got out of that jam in six pitches, runners on second and third, one out, he gets two outs like that in a 4-2 game. That's huge. And that's, again, coming off the heels of a really bad Ian Hamilton performance. Ian Hamilton placed on the COVID IL today, guys, in case you haven't seen. So we'll be without him until next Monday or Sunday.
He's the first Yankee placed on the COVID IL since June 2022, and he is the 89th Yankee to have COVID during that period of time. So that's how you know it's weird. I haven't seen the COVID IL used in a long time. I don't know if this is some kind of cutesy roster manipulation to get him low. Probably is exactly that, but he does have by the books has the novel coronavirus and will not be pitching for a little while.
You think they saw him cough and they were like, "Come here, we got to give you a test," and they already had the test pre-programmed to be a false positive, and they're like, "Oh, week off for you, sorry, buddy." Not in a bad way. Something's been up with Hamilton. We haven't been able to put our finger on it. We suspect – well, we always fucking suspect injury when something's going on. But
there was some – one of those games he wasn't used and he should have been, and Michael Kay said he was having trouble getting loose the next day or bouncing back or whatever. It's amazing he's pitched since then, and he's pitched fairly well this season. Not, people call things ironically, call them Linsanity runs way too much. Last year might have been a Linsanity run for Ian Hamilton. He's got the goods. I don't think he's like the setup man on a great team. And he probably needed some time off, whether he has COVID or not. And he does. Seems like he has COVID. I'm legally required to say that he has COVID, but he's certainly not going to be pitching for about a week or so.
Yeah. So anyway, he comes in third of an inning, three hits and a run, 18 pitches. And you're just like, what, dude? Come on.
Not now. Don't do it now.
Not now, my friend. But anyway, Caleb Ferguson helps him get this. This is why the bullpen's really cool. They just – everybody picks each other up, even when they're not the suspected capable performer. So Caleb Ferguson getting that under his belt I think is a huge confidence boost. Hopefully he rides with it. But, yeah, that was shocking to me that he was able – that, A, he came in dual surprise. A, he came in for that moment. B, he got out of it. So, bravo.
Quickly, too, so quickly. In the era of the three-batter minimum, you're going to let him – you're bringing him in for Benintendi, and then with two outs and second and third, in your ideal scenario, like if this works and Benintendi doesn't drive in a run and makes an out, second and third – tying run at second for a righty? Ah! But, hey, I'm not the manager. Shout out Aaron Boone, like you said. Two quickies before we sign off. Giancarlo Stanton, apology necessary? He's probably not making the All-Star team, but the fact that I can start this segment by saying he's probably not making the All-Star team is enough of an argument that he's already had a successful season and probably deserves a notarized letter of apology from yours truly. 252 average, just fine. 11 bombs right up there with Soto and Judge. 128 OPS plus, positive war, 0.6 B war right now. If this is all you get from him, and I sure hope it's not, but if it is, already a more successful season than I expected it to be for Giancarlo Stanton, who that doesn't even tell the full story. The wrist splits, as we've gone over repeatedly, and he had a little cool little clutch broken bat hit in the Minnesota series. Right now, he's not even hitting lefties as well as he usually does. Typically, that's his thing. He's hitting 255 with an 889 OPS against righties, and in 46 plate appearances against lefties, 639 OPS. His numbers could get better if he ticks up to career norms there with runners in scoring position. He is still hitting 361 with a 1092 OPS in 40 plate appearances, 36 at-bats, including sac flies and walks. Again, not getting ahead of our skis, anyone ask me, is Giancarlo Stanton back? Like, is he just good now? Tao is not like his fully realized monstrous Giancarlo Stanton, but did I ever expect to see this from him again after the second half of 2022 and all of 2023? No, I did not. Already delivered more than I expected this year.
Yeah. If anybody, I owe him a sort of an apology. I didn't call for his DFA. At least I don't remember. You could, maybe I can be Colin Cowherd and like someone does a compilation of me, like where it's, I'm saying the most absurd shit that I claim that I never even thought of. Yeah. But yeah, I felt like my line for all these discussions, whenever the discourse around Giancarlo Stanton got difficult, was just like, find a team who's willing to take the risk.
Yeah.
And they have to take on most of the money. Obviously, there was a situation where the Yankees probably would have had to eat in some money, but never in a million years would you want to eat $80-something million, have Giancarlo Stanton go play somewhere else and potentially kick your ass. Like, I know that the fit here isn't ideal. He shouldn't necessarily be eating up this DH spot for the rest of time. But again, he can do that if he bats 250-ish and OPS is over 800. And hits home runs, and that's exactly what he's doing. And to boot, the runners in scoring position numbers are insane. And the reverse splits, he's destroying right-handed hitters. I don't know how it's happening. So, again, another situation where the party's probably going to end somewhat soon, but we've gotten exactly what we've needed from Giancarlo Stanton over the first 2 months of the season. He shook off that painful first, 10 days of the year? Really, really bad showing, and it made you think, well, great, we're in for more of the same. We're going to have this uncomfortable discussion in three more weeks, and we're not going to be able to get to enjoy what the Yankees should be as a 2024 contender with Juan Soto here for a year, Alex Verdugo here for a year. But the home runs that he's hit this year, absolutely incredible. Like they again are one of a kind. We may not see another player in our lifetime hit home runs in the manner that he does. Mm-hmm. The breaker, or the, was it the changeup or the curveball off Chris Paddock, muscling mm-hmm. that in the left center. Even that oppo shot yesterday against Brad Keller, it was like Brad Keller just loops one in there and he just like flick of the wrist, boom, point. Right center field into the bullpen. Fucking see ya. The rocket into the left field seats. It like, it was so fast and had such a bizarre launch angle that it went under this, the awning into like 10 rows back into the shadows where it was like, that's even possible to hit a line drive like that. So, I will say that I have incessantly talked about loving watching Giancarlo Stanton on his absolute heaters. Mm-hmm. When he's making contact, when he's seeing a beach ball, there's nothing like it. And, you know, he got asked a dumb question in the post game about how, oh, you think you and Judge have hit enough homers in the same game? It's like, no, the answer is no, they haven't.
What would that mean? What an eye roll. Yeah.
I don't know what exactly the question was, but it was something cheesy where it was like, oh, how'd you feel hitting a home run in the same game as Aaron Judge? And it's like, yeah, what do you mean, dude? It's all anybody's fucking wished for since 2017. This is all anybody's talked about.
It's like
every single stat you see is like, oh, home runs with Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton in the lineup. 5,000 when they play together. When they don't play together, it's nothing. So this is great. Don't need Giancarlo Stanton playing MVP levels. I literally just need like 240, 250 from him and like a low 800 OPS. I'm not asking for a lot. If he just does his bit, the walks are never going to be there. So deal with that. We just need the extra base hits and we need the majestic home runs and we're good.
Yeah. It's not groundbreaking. It's like the Nixon Anunoby. Like it's, hey, when he plays, they're 26-5. When they both homer, the Yankees are like 30-2. And it doesn't happen nearly often enough. And when it does, guess what? It works. So we'll take as much Stanton as we can get. The other key component of the Judge Stanton Soto trifecta, Juan Soto. Just before we sign off, I want to note to everybody again, file this away under things that don't mean anything, but would be a little weird if they didn't actually mean anything. Also, after we heard that Steinbrenner wants to open negotiations in season and Scott Boras would be open to it. And Juan Soto says, talk to Scott Boras, and everybody sort of is lining up their numbers. And all we know for sure is that anyone who said that Hal wasn't serious about this is wrong. He clearly is. Who knows where Soto goes? I think he stays here.
Who said
but either
that?
Way, people have been saying that all year. Like, oh, they got him for 1 year. They're saying, you know, all the people who read the Cashman quotes were like, he said, enjoy the year.
Oh my God.
Party. Like the Yankees clearly don't care about him long-term. They're just getting him as a rental. Okay, cool. At the Yankees welcome home dinner, which I would love to attend someday. Love inside jokes. Would love to be part of one someday. Juan Soto bid $16,000 to win a painting of himself in Yankee pinstripes and a Yankee hat.
Cool.
Again, I ask you, does that sound like the actions of a man who does not intend to stay a Yankee? You think he wants a framed photo of the Yankee? You think he's having such a bad time learning the franchise in the city that he wants a framed painting for $16,000 to remind him of his worst mistake before joining the New York Mets? Get real. Hal's going to come to play. Soto appears amenable. I'm not guaranteeing it. I never will. But if Juan Soto did leave the Yankees paying $16,000 for a painting of him in a Yankees uniform, when, spoiler alert, he could get one for cheaper, seems to indicate that maybe he intends to stick around for a while. And again, I don't think Hal brought him here to nickel and dime him. Hal is the one who, when he sees something he likes, he closes it like he did with Aaron Judge. I can't get over the idea that they're just going to let this one slip and at the end of the year go, whoops, what can you do? It's a business. If they lose him, they're going down fighting. And if they do lose him, he's going to have one hell of a pointless painting because he just spent $16,000 on a painting of himself in a Yankees uniform. So again, doesn't mean anything necessarily, but if it ended up not meaning anything, you'd look back and go, that's pretty weird. That didn't mean anything. Yeah. Feels like it maybe means something.
Yeah. This discourse is pissing me off. I mean, part of it is inevitable, right? Like this subject has to come up from time to time. Like there is an elephant in the room in a sense. And I like that Hal Steinbrenner brought it up, because in a way it will shut any fan up who's thinking that the Yankees aren't going to be serious players for him. Like, there was I think we talked about it last podcast, that David Sampson was on foul territory.
Yeah.
And he was saying that, you know, if a player wants to be a lifer on a team, he doesn't have Scott Boras as an agent. And that the Yankees aren't going to get into dangerous bidding territory with Juan Soto because they're trying to be smart with their payroll. And it's like, we just had the perfect example of a player wanting to be a lifer this offseason when Jose Altuve, a Scott Boras client, signed an under the market contract extension to essentially remain an Astro for life. He signed a 5-year, $125 million deal, I think. That takes him towards the end of his playing days. And he signed a contract extension previously before that. Alex Bregman, also a Boras client, I believe. Am I wrong?
No, that's right.
That's right. Signed that contract extension early on with the Astros 4 or 5 years ago. I'm not saying that you have the examples like Chris Bryant, who signed a bullshit deal with the Rockies, who clearly didn't value any legacy and took the money and ran with it.
I think he's sad about it now, though.
Well, he's definitely probably sad about it now. Who else do we have in recent years? We have
every Scott Boras client who entered the market this year and thought they were going to get 6 or 7 years and ended up getting one or two in weird cities.
Yeah, I mean, those are hard to kind of even use as examples because they didn't get nobody got anything they wanted there. They didn't get the destination, they didn't get the money, and they didn't really have the opportunity to make that tough decision.
They didn't get the women, they didn't get the power.
Yeah. and then on the second end of that question is like, do we really think, if you want to compare it to the Judge situation, right, do we really think Juan Soto doesn't care about his legacy? And I'm not saying the Yankees are the best possible destination for him to forward his legacy. I think it's one of three best destinations out there. I would there's an argument for it to be number one, but to say that he's definitely going for the most money regardless of destination is crazy, because Juan Soto is a competitor. Have you watched any of his interviews this year? Did you watch him call out the Padres last year for playing like shit and having no energy during a stretch where they should have been winning baseball games? Like, this is not a guy who comes and goes. This is a guy who legitimately leads by example. He is someone who's working out nonstop. He's someone who's helping out his teammates constantly. This is not somebody who's saying, oh, you know what? I got offered actually the most money from the Marlins, Yankees. So I'm going to take the extra $50 million. And I really thank you for that year. So I'm drawing that parallel because a lot of the discussion has been the Mets, right? And it's like, oh, you know, Steve Cohen, he's going to offer whatever it takes, and Soto's going to take it. If Soto's watching anything that's been happening with the Mets for the past 9 years, there is no reason for him to ever sign a contract there, regardless of how much money it's for. It needs to start with a B. It needs to be a $1 billion contract, in my opinion, for him to say, you know what? I am going to forego all these perennial contending teams who are offering me a semblance of a record-breaking contract, and I'm going to go to the Mets. Because David Sampson's talking like this is Scott Boras's decision, right? He's like, you know, Boras is going to control the market, and he's going to have control over what Juan Soto does and what Juan Soto says. It's like, no, Boras's job is to drive the price up in every corner of the market to give Juan Soto the best earning power he can in any market that he wants. So if that means, okay, let's drive Steve Cohen up to $600 million, that means Yankees probably got to go five. That's just what it means. And that is going to put Soto in a good position to make the most money he can possible in the destination that he wants to remain in and keep him in the Hall of Fame legacy World Series every year discussion. So that's where Scott Boras comes into play. Scott Boras is not saying, oh, well, you know what, Juan, we got the most money from the worst team out there, so we're going to sign on with them because that helps my commission check. Yeah. Juan Soto doesn't give a fuck about what Scott Boras is making on the commission check. All he cares about is how much money he's going to be making in the setting that he wants to be in for this is a remainder of his career contract, unless he decides to do something crazy and sign insane high AAV 1 or 2 year deals, which I don't think he's doing. This is going to be a Shohei Ohtani-esque contract extension. It's going to take him through the end of his career. So for anybody debating any of this and to suggest that the Yankees aren't serious about it, when this is the exact contract the Yankees would love to sign. Great. We got a guy who's 25 years old. Here's all the money. We know we're getting the prime years. This isn't a situation where you're like, oh man, we're signing an age 30 pitcher to a 7 year contract. I guess we're eating 3 years. No, you're getting 80% of Juan Soto's peak powers with this contract. The Yankees are 100% in on it, regardless of what the price point is going to be.
You know how I know they're 100% in on a 25-year-old hitting free agency? Because they were going to pay $300 million to a 25-year-old pitcher hitting free agency who had never appeared in a Major League Baseball game before. Yep. And they got outfoxed because they don't have Shohei Ohtani. Now, something tells me it'll be a slightly different sales pitch for Juan Soto. We shall see. Look, I don't know. The reason I love winning so much and 7-game winning streaks is because you get to talk about, man, is this the best team in baseball? Rather than, will they pay one of the guys currently on the roster? Can we do November? We do November talk in May?
Yeah.
That's for the Mets fans. Let the Mets fans do November talk in May. We're going to talk about Juan Soto buying an expensive painting and hopefully telegraphing his future ambitions as well as the team being on a red hot heater and going toe-to-toe with another one of the pitching staffs that definitely rivals them for one of the best in baseball at this moment in time. The Seattle Mariners and New York Yankees in a 4-game set this week. Night game, afternoon game. And sorry, good job by the New York Knicks. We no longer have double playoff series. They did their very best. And honestly, if they'd won yesterday, I would have been scared for them to face the Boston Celtics because I don't know how many limbs they had left. And I'm not sure how they would have left that series intact and able to walk. But the New York Rangers see you in the Eastern Conference Finals Wednesday night, game one of that series. The Rangers have a legit shot, one of the final four, and they will not be facing the Boston Bruins. That feels a little bit good, too. For all the folks out there who are like, wow, it's going to be New York and Boston in the NBA and NHL. It's not going to be New York-Boston in either of those. And in one of those instances, that's pretty good. It's nice to not have to see them. Florida Panthers are good. Rangers are good. Bruins are less good. Now they're gone. I love New York. Can't wait to watch this exciting Yankee series. The Yankees have set themselves up to have a fun one, to have a good enough record at 33-15 that we can enter this tough test and say this will be fun rather than say, uh-oh, we have a tough test after we just bombed two other easier tests. This is not interesting. Should be fun. We'll be on during Thursday's show again. Unless there's a developing story and a reason.
Day game again.
Yeah. I think it's a noon game.
It's 12:35.
Yeah. So we'll see you live during that.
Kirby. Pretty great.
Yeah. We'll see you live during that one, unless there's a reason to wait till the end of the game, in which case we will. But hey, either way, turn your notifications on. We'll be here on Thursday, probably pretty close to 2:00 Eastern. After this live stream, stay tuned on the audio feed for a short interview with Andy Martino, which is also going live on the YouTube channel. If you prefer to just watch it, you can turn those same notifications on. You'll get alerted that we have another video up. You get to watch that. But if you want to listen in the comfort of your home, just stick around. Let this marinate. Let this feed continue. I'm Adam Weinerb. You can find me on still Twitter at Adam Weinerb. Thomas Carinante, where can the people find you? And you're not going to say it, are you? You're still not going to say it.
I don't know. You think anyone's holding me to my promise?
No, I don't think you have to. I don't really care.
Am on Twitter.
Twitter.com.
Twitter.com. Tommy's underscore. Does it still redirect you?
Let's find out. I'm literally on it right now. Let's find out. Twitter.com.
You're damn right it does.
It sure does.
So until they axe that old URL, it is still Twitter.com. I am at Tommy's underscore takes. We are both at the official Yanks Go Yard Twitter account at Yanks Go Yard FS. Thank you guys for tuning in. We appreciate it. Head on over to YanksGoYard.com. We got plenty of content there for you, staying on top of everything Yankees. The code for Caesars, again, YGY1000 for a risk-free bet. Pretty good deal. Again, we'll be back here Thursday, 2 p.m. Eastern live. During the game, we're going to be having some fun. Stay tuned for the Andy Martino interview, and we will see you guys soon.
Take care, everybody. Take care of yourselves. Come on, Yankees, do your thing. Keep doing your thing. Don't stop doing your thing. See you on Thursday. Adam Weinrib and Thomas Carinante here on the Yanks Go Yard podcast, joined today by Andy Martino, who you certainly know from SNY, his book, The Yankee Way, about the Brian Cashman era. An inside look we didn't think most people could get about the era drops on May 21st. Andy, we really appreciate you joining us to hopefully shed some more light on somebody and somebody whose work we are obviously obsessed with in the day to day.
Understandable. Plenty of people are passionate about this team, maybe more so than any other. I can't scientifically prove that, but certainly you could make an argument the Yankees have the biggest, most passionate fan base of any franchise in the world. So a lot of people care about what this man does.
Well, thanks for helping pull the curtain back a little bit. I think what I'm most curious about is you've already revealed some tidbits from the book and also just described the ways that you've gotten access and the way that it's changed your relationship with Brian Cashman. What will surprise Yankee fans most about Brian Cashman's tenure and process, even his mood after reading this book?
I think that's a really good question. A couple things spring to mind. I think that it might surprise Yankee fans how highly regarded Cashman is within the game, considering that people understandably get caught up in the day to day, which isn't always great, obviously. But there was a point where I was interviewing Billy Bean, and I said, do you think Brian Cashman's a future Hall of Famer? And Bean actually got a little annoyed with me. He was like, I cannot even believe you're asking that question. Brian, when you say that man's name, you should say future Hall of Famer with every sentence, basically as if you were talking about Max Scherzer or whatnot. And he says, in fact, I would go on to say that he's the greatest executive in the history of sports. I said, really? I said, why would you say that? He said, well, if you look at the pressures he's under, if you look at the decades and decades of winning, if you look at the fact that he's never taken a year off or tried to rebuild or retool. I mean, there have been little steps back that they've taken, but certainly never tanking. In the way the Orioles and the Astros, for example, get to success, they've never allowed themselves to do that. So that kind of full-throated praise definitely contradicts in some ways the way that Cashman has talked about on a daily basis. And what's interesting too is I talked to Brian Sabian who, before he came back to work for Cashman. This interview happened before that. And he said the same thing. He said, Brian is the greatest executive in the history of the sport. And he didn't know that Bean had said it. So that might surprise some people who don't think of him that way. It might surprise some people. I know it's known that some tensions have existed between Cashman and Jeter and Cashman and Joe Torre and Cashman and A-Rod. The extent of those, in particular with Jeter and Torre, might surprise people. I had the story in there about how Cashman and Torre had their falling out, which I don't believe has been told before. It might surprise people to see this isn't a Cashman-specific point because it's not his biography. It's really about the Yankees and the time that he was there. So not a Cashman point, but all this talk about analytics in kind of a simplified way, is it well done or is it not well done? Is it too much? Is it not? There's some really nuanced stuff in there from Garrett Cole and Zach Britton and some others about the good and the bad. And it will not surprise fans to hear that the clubhouse was up in arms about the Davey Garcia J-Hap opener game. That was not a shocker to reveal, but I've got Britton saying, people were going, we're the fucking Yankees. What are we doing? Like within the clubhouse. Those are some things I would say, some surprises and not so surprises.
I would call those surprises and good tidbits. I mean, fans will, I think they'll be shocked to hear some of those things, and then they'll be validated to hear something about the opener because fans are dying for validation for some of the criticisms that have been, you know, outwardly spoken about over the last few years. But for you, Andy, this is a huge undertaking. Like, you're an insider in the New York sports realm and getting in the weeds with a book like this and your interview subject being somebody who, you know, you have close connections with to break news is a big deal. So like, do you feel Cashman was trusting you more or less during this process? Has this affected your relationship with any other like employees in the Yankees organization?
I would say, was he trusting me more or less? Like, you mean more or less than other reporters or more or less than he's trusted me?
Than he's trusted you previously.
That's an interesting question. I would say that we have a respectful, like reporter subject relationship, whether it's the daily or whether it's this. I think he knows that I'm not someone who's out there to be either like a shill for him or be unnecessarily sensationalistic. I try to play it down the middle. And I think he trusts that when he tells me something, I don't want to speak for him, but I'd venture to say that when he tells me something, he knows it'll come out. It'll be written in a like grown up way that he meant it. So maybe there was some of that that went into it over the course of the book. He definitely opened up more than he would in the day to day because there's strategy in the day to day. If I were to call him up, like we're recording this on a day, I know it's not airing today. We're recording this on a day where there are rumors about the Yankees and Dylan Cease yet again. So if I were to call him up right now, it wouldn't be like, hey, who are you offering? What are they offering? What? I mean, he's got to be more guarded than that for strategy purposes. That's not our relationship. But if I said, take me inside trading David Wells for Roger Clemens, you give all the dirty details. So there's probably a level of trust there because of the time that's passed and some of the stuff. Although the book comes right up to the present day and he talks openly at the very end of the book about his own future. And he trusted me with that. Another tidbit in there that might surprise people is that after the 22 season, when his contract was up, he got way closer to leaving than anyone, including Hal Steinbrenner, realized. A recruiter, a headhunter type, contacted him. He didn't do the outreach, but he answered. And they started talking like, hey, what would you do if you weren't doing this? And there was more of those kind of conversations. And when I asked Hal about it, he was like, I didn't think he was going to leave. And I was like, well, interestingly, he was thinking about it. So he trusted me with that. I'd like to think it's because he knows that I'll present it factually and without a spin one way or the other. Maybe he'll read it and wish he hadn't. I don't know. I can't speak to that. But I'd like to think I presented it responsibly in the spirit it was told to me. Maybe he sees that I'm the kind of person that does that. I don't
know. This is so eye-opening. And that history versus modern day thing that you're describing definitely also sounds like the way I've heard Bill Belichick described recently.
Sure.
So not for nothing, but it is eye-opening to me even to hear you say, like, hey, you might keep current stuff safeguarded a little bit, but you want him to open up on the last 20 years of Yankees history, he'll certainly go for it, which leads me into this thought that this offseason, there was this chatter about an audit, about sort of an internal process audit. And fans never really knew how far that went, how far it was ever intended to go. But as someone who's talked with Brian Cashman about 20 plus years of processes and is now hearing Steinbrenner and Cashman both at least tangentially talk about making sweeping internal changes that might be more subtle to the naked eye. Do you feel like that kind of revolution was necessary for things to get back on track, or if it was just sort of something you have to say, whereas they continue to trust this process that you've detailed in the book?
So that was a weird one, that so-called audit, because it never happened and it never was going to happen. And that was something that I eventually got to figuring out in my daily coverage, actually, like, because I was like, wait a minute, who's what audit? Who are they? What's this? Who's coming in? What are they doing? And finally, I was told, like, no, nobody's coming in. And I don't know where that started. Nobody I had to go back and research this at the time to write the news story. And no one from the Yankees ever said there were articles written about changes and things like that. And Hal Steinbrenner did make one comment. I don't remember the verbatim offhand, but it was like, we're going to take a look at everything, including the analytics. And maybe that misled people a little bit. But then I don't know. It just got this thing took on a life of its own that the Yankees are being audited. And are they going to audit the trainers? Are they going to audit the analytics guys? Are they going to audit the coaches? The only thing that happened there was that Michael Fishman and David Grabner, who were two of their main analytics guys, for years have been wanting to hire this outside firm, not even hire. What you do is you look at the way this firm does analytics and you compare it to the way you do analytics and you look for similarities and differences and ways you can tighten it up. That's it. So no one's ever looked at the Yankees in an audit type way from the outside, and no one was ever going to. That finally got cleared up. I mean, I wrote about it, and then Cashman finally, I think he said at the winter meetings, like, publicly, I don't know what this is, what you all are talking about, but there's no audit. That's a paraphrase, not a direct quote, of course, but no, he doesn't believe it's necessary. In fact, he believes that their operation is pretty fucking good, if you remember that quote. And that was, I was there for all 67 minutes of that. And it's I got it in the book, is one of the last scenes, because that was an example of, he's sick of hearing that this thing is completely broken when he believes that they are starving for a championship. but the process and their people he's proud of. So the perception that there needed to be an audit was probably part of what animated that rant. And he's feeling defensive on behalf of the Michael Fishmans and the Tim Nearings, who's his top scout, and people like that who were being told through fans and through some media that they're horrible, when Cashman's like, I've got good people and I'm sick of hearing them and me put down. So that's kind of where that came from. It was in that whole time where the audit was a bit of a topic, even though it wasn't real. It was a weird one.
Yeah, glad you brought that up, Andy. The, I think it was the GM meetings back in back in November or December. Yeah. Forgot it's this offseason.
November, been, yeah.
Drag. But yeah, we had that incident. Everybody reported on it. It was a good old time. Some people had their fun. A lot of people had questions. And you've been close with Cashman for a while. You got even more closer with him as you were writing this book and interviewing him about things. What do you think spurred? I know you were mentioning that he felt a certain way about his people being criticized, but that was uncharacteristic of him for a multitude of reasons. One, he's usually guarded in a lot of his responses. We've been covering the Yankees for a while, and we know that about him. He's a very calculated, strategic executive. And two, for someone who's been working in the New York, you know, sphere and media for so long, he's kind of known not to blow up like that, right? Because, like, you know what the repercussions are. So what do you think, like, how did that all come to be? And did you talk to him more in depth about how he felt about expressing himself like that? Because that was something fans were talking about, very confused about, thought like it was the tipping point, like representative of how everything's kind of gone wayside in the front office from an outside perspective. So we would love some clarity on that for the fans to understand a little bit better.
Yeah, more so than that, actually, internally, it was seen as he was reclaiming his voice as like, wait a minute, shut up, we're good. Like, I think that was more, less than like, oh, my God, he's coming apart at the seams. So I'll take you back. I did talk to him about it and experienced it and have been around the Yankees for a couple of years where they've started to feel like they're getting too much criticism. Now, we could have a whole side discussion on where they're right and where they're wrong about that, but I'll just present to you like the reporting on how they feel, and that they feel that they've got a good analytics staff. They certainly could improve some of their communication, which they've made an effort to do and they continually do. They're proud of how they talk to, before this all came out, by this interview with Britton and Cole in the book. And they're like, every year Cashman and Gene Afterman ask us, how are we communicating this stuff to players? What can we do better? So they're hearing this when they know privately that they've been working on this all along and they're being talked about as if they never thought of it. They know they've made mistakes. They know the opener game was a mistake. So they know they're not perfect, but they think they have a good process. And I think Michael Fishman in particular is somebody who is a quiet guy, a very understated guy, hardworking, loyal. And just hearing him and his analytics department get beat up, there was an aspect of Cashman, like a manager wanting to protect his player at a certain point, like, enough, this is my guy that you're talking about. So there's some of that. He feels really good about, so when he hears the overly analytic thing, he's like, I have Tim Nearing, who is a gifted evaluator. He has Brian Sabian, Omar Minaya, Jim Hendry. He's like, what are you talking about? Like, show me these people in the Mets front office or the anyone else's, you know, that builds up over time. I know that getting swept in the ALCS obviously hurt, but what also didn't make sense to them was, and this is of course in 22, was that being covered like it was a disaster. Internally, they're like, we're in the final four. Like, what is your problem? And again, the Yankees lay out certain expectations that their fans have bought into. So I get that it's nuanced, but this is where they're thinking. Like, they're like, tell us, fine, tell us we didn't get to the World Series. We wish we had. Don't tell us that our season was broken. We made it to the ALCS. Anyway, so that stuff's building up. There are columns in the mainstream media written, like, after that Houston series, Hal Steinbrenner should fire himself, and everything should be on the table, and maybe the Yankees should blow it up. So that built up. You go through a whole other very difficult season, even much more difficult season, of course, 82-80, but it felt much worse for a lot of it. They kind of recovered in the end to get over .500, to recover to an extent. So it's just bad vibes, bad energy for people that are proud of the work that they do and competitive. It's just an awful year for them, the way they felt, in addition to the way their fans felt. So that builds up. They don't feel the coverage is fair. Twitter exists. These people all deny that they look at it much, but come on, like, they're human beings. I don't believe that Brian Cashman has never searched Brian Cashman on Twitter. And I know this. People can beat me up on Twitter. When you know you do a good job and work hard and people tell you you're a fraud, you're human. That might bother you a little bit in the wrong moment. So that stuff builds up. Get to that moment. The audit's being talked about. We are at the winter meetings in Phoenix. Yeah, we were in Phoenix. And Cashman, there's a general availability in the middle of the afternoon. All the ALGMs have to come out. They all start coming out of their suites to meet the media with their PR guys. And Cashman, I didn't see this, but I was told later, turns to Jason Zillow, his PR guy, and says, I think I'm going to go for it here. Like, I think this is going to be something, that kind of thing. And as soon as the first expectedly tough question happened, he just decided to be himself and let it out and not contain it anymore. And he felt like he was an out of body experience. When Zillow wrapped it after 67 minutes, which is a very long amount of time, longer than any of the other GMs, and said, "All right, guys, one more." He heard that and he was like, "Already?" He couldn't believe it was almost over. And then apparently someone else told me this. He went back to the team suite after that, and another person in the organization saw him flop on a couch like he just went 10 rounds or something. So they let it all out. And notably, for Yankee morale, I was in it's a very small property where everyone, media and team people, are around each other. So I was at the bar at this property later that night. Cashman was not there, but some of his people were, and they were expressing such appreciation that he had stuck up for them. So that was part of the point, I think. Regardless of how it looked to the public, these people deserve me to defend them. So I think that's a lot of where it came from.
Yes.
Look, I think it was partially cool. We do have to acknowledge that, right?
We think it's cool.
We thought it was cool, and then we're like, wait, though, is something else? Is he going crazy a little bit? I don't know.
I mean, maybe a little bit, but mostly he's calculating. He knows what he's doing. Yeah. He knew there were headlines and back pages that were going to come out of that. Not that he wants that, but he understands, like, in that case, it's worth it. Let's go.
That was the risk he was willing to take.
Yeah. One final question. We'll wrap here. This sort of ties into your closeness to the process and to 20 years of process. I think fans who are sitting outside the room sometimes look at trades that look, your most demanding fans will follow up any trade or signing the Yankees don't make by asking why they didn't do that. But a lot of people who analyze these things a little closer do look around and see something like Corbin Burnes get dealt for prospects who they don't believe are on the level of Spencer Jones, but they hear the Yankees are asked for Spencer Jones, that kind of thing. I'm wondering any insight you could possibly share into whether Brian Cashman and his lieutenants sort of feel as if there is this Yankees tax where they're going to have to pay 1.5 where the Orioles get to pay less. Yeah,
they do feel that way. Absolutely. Especially in division that happens. Maybe it depends on the trade partner. They have trade partners that they deal with and feel like are dealing in good faith. And there is that Yankee tax thing that happens too. But I think even more than that, it's they're focused on evaluating each transaction and for the value of that transaction. And one thing that may end up looking good or bad, depending on how this season goes, but that his lieutenants appreciate is that he is very much in an aggressive win now mode more than usual, but he's not willing to sell out the future either. He's still trying to strike that balance and what's good for the organization. You could not say that about Dave Dombrowski. That's an in the moment guy, and the Phillies will probably pay for it in a few years. Will it have been worth it? That's a whole discussion. Maybe it is, but Cashman's not going to trade a Spencer Jones if he doesn't feel that it's the right deal, trade an Anthony Volpe a few years ago. He's not buying into narrative. He's not buying into fan desire. They have one guy in the Yankees front office calls it the puke point. Like, where's my puke point on this deal, whether it's money or players? And like, Dylan Cease and Corbin Burns are just past the puke point with those ass stars. Sorry, it makes me want to puke. Can't do it. The Soto trade was – the Michael King thing was at the puke point, but they were like, okay, it's Juan Soto, and they just – they did it. But that's how they think of it. Each transaction in its own merits, is this a good deal? Does it make sense? And that's why they lose out on some of the things that maybe people want them to do. And sometimes they end up looking good and sometimes not so much.
Well, depending on how the next 48 hours or so go, we might be reaching our personal puke point about this upcoming season. We really do appreciate you sticking it out with us. We can't wait for the book, The Yankee Way, May 21st, the inside look at Brian Cashman's era, his years with the franchise, and it seems like they're poised to continue for a while. Andy Martino, thank you so much for making the time for us.
Thank you so much, guys, for having me. I appreciate it.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.